News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Paul Grundy of IBM Global Healthcare about transforming the healthcare industry. Really an incredible, fascinating topic that I think all of our listeners will be very interested in.
And we had a chance to meet him when he came to visit our department in Chapel Hill. So I know I'm excited to hear how the conversation goes today.
But first, we have some really interesting research that matters that I think will be relevant to virtually all of our listeners. What do we have?
The first one is about secondhand smoke, and it's a relationship to mental health.
Well, you know, we've talked a lot about secondhand smoke, that smoke that that we breathe in that other smokers are smoking. And we see this a lot more actually now in outdoor environments because of people moving outdoors to smoke.
Mm-hmm.
We also see this a lot for children who are in cars with smokers, or maybe people who share dorm rooms and students and others, or live in a house with smokers.
Yeah, and we know that the other people's smoke is bad for your lungs and bad for your heart, but this is about a relationship of secondhand smoke potentially being bad for your mental health too. So a study looking at non-smokers who are exposed to a lot of secondhand smoke and finding that they're more likely to have psychological or mental distress than those who aren't exposed to that sort of smoke.
Yeah, this article in the Archives of General Psychiatry looked at over 5,000 non-smoking adults and almost 3,000 smoking adults, none of whom had a history of mental illness. And then they looked at questions about psychological distress and admission to psychiatric hospitals over 6 years.
And they found that there were people who were exposed to a lot of secondhand smoke were 50% more likely to have psychological distress, and they were at much higher risk, triple risk of being admitted to a psychiatric hospital over the next 6 years from the beginning of the study.
Yeah, and this was much stronger for never smokers than for ex-smokers. And so it really suggests that there is something going on here that if you are exposed to secondhand smoke, that your risk of having psychological – we know among smokers it's higher, but even among the non-smokers exposed to secondhand smoke, there are higher risk of variety of mental health issues. We don't know why.
We don't. There has been a little evidence in animal studies showing a link between tobacco and depression of mood and a potential link between smoking and depression. So I guess the idea that some of the chemicals may have an effect on the brain is plausible. It's possible.
Yeah. Or maybe it's just with the smokers who have more psychological problems that there's some co-things happening here being
mm-hmm.
around that. But regardless, it is a health risk, lots of reasons to avoid it. And here's one more. What do we have next?
The next is about fish oil supplements and about whether kids could benefit from taking fish oil supplements.
Do you take fish oil supplements?
I do not.
I don't, but I'm going in for a physical soon, and I think that I might start doing it. You know, there's all this research out there about fish oil supplements being good for lowering your blood pressure and improving your cholesterol profile. And not too many side effects that I've read about other than some minor gastrointestinal stomach issues.
Sure. I do try to eat more fish and try to get my kids to eat more fish, but I haven't yet made the dive into supplements.
This article in the Journal of Pediatrics really looking at the benefits of fish oil supplements and do they extend to children?
So this was a study of 880 slightly overweight boys age 13 to 15.
Danish boys. This is not the U.S. boys. It's our Danish friends. The Netherlands are our World Cup runner-ups.
Yes, and they randomly divided these kids into two groups. One group received daily doses of fish oil, about 1.5 grams, about 1.5 soft gels, and the other group received equivalent amounts of vegetable oils, and they put that into bread so that the kids couldn't taste what they were getting.
Yeah, hard to believe.
Hard
to believe they didn't know they were getting oily bread
right
there. But regardless, and they looked at these these Danish youth for 16 weeks, and they showed that those that had the fish oil bread had almost 4 millimeters of mercury lower systolic blood pressure. That's that top number, and almost 3 millimeters of the diastolic, the lower number. So lower blood pressure compared to those who did not have this.
And that's pretty – I mean, 3 or 4 beats points of blood pressure sounds like maybe it's not very much. But in adults, dropping blood pressure by 3 millimeters or 3 points corresponds to at least a 15% reduction in the risk of stroke. So the idea is that by doing this in children over the long term, it may have health benefits.
Sure, because blood pressure – readings in early life also track into adulthood, and so the children and adolescents with higher blood pressure at that age will have higher blood pressure later in life. So I think one take-home message from this is, because there weren't that many, again, side effects they didn't talk about,
sure.
Mentioned, but it would be that if you have a child or an adolescent with borderline or even elevated blood pressure
or weight,
that blood fish oil might be something worth considering, because this was in a lower dose than what's standardly used to treat adults.
And for me with children, I'm just thinking, are we getting enough fish in our diet as well?
Yep.
So what do we have next, Adam?
Well, we're going to revisit the question of brushing teeth. And we've had some shows on oral health and talked about the benefits of good oral health here. And this is actually some interesting research because it's so simple, which is that if you brush your teeth at least twice a day, is that left you have less heart disease risk than if you don't brush it twice a day? And I started thinking, well, God, goodness gracious, how many people don't brush your teeth twice a day?
Yeah, pretty interesting and applicable to our lives. So this was a study of nearly 1,200 adults in Scotland, and it did find a link between poor oral hygiene and risk of heart disease.
Yeah, there was a 70% extra risk if you didn't brush your teeth at least twice a day of heart disease among those groups compared to those that brushed it twice a day. Now, while the overall risk was low, this was something that you certainly could do something about, and it's kind of interesting because I remember, like, I heard in the back of my mind, one of my children recently asked me, "Dad, do you brush your teeth twice a day?" I don't, and I'm starting to think, "You don't?
You don't?
I hope you do it at least once a day." But you know, we just maybe take it for common. How many patients do we have, Christy, that we've had the conversation? How often do you brush your teeth?
Absolutely.
I haven't done it very much.
Well, I do it with parents for children as part of the routine well child check.
Maybe the parents like
me
don't really know.
Sure,
particularly as the kids get to be teenagers.
Sure. And something like heart disease, I mean, we're not talking about an uncommon problem. This is the leading killer of men and women across the globe. In Europe, United States, and many of the rich nations have a problem with heart disease. And it's certainly a problem in our country. So
yeah,
this is something simple you could do.
And they say, talk about this being an old story, because back in the 1800s, there was this theory called focal sepsis. And the people believe that infections in the mouth caused systemic diseases, and they took everyone's teeth out. Now, a little dramatic. Don't think I would go there, but maybe we should be brushing our teeth at least twice, 3 times a day.
Okay. Well, the next one is about decreasing falls in the elderly. And Adam, we've talked about this many times on the show, what an important problem falling can be for an elderly person, and wanting to look for ways to decrease that risk.
Yeah, and this article in the British Medical Journal actually, the last article was also in the British Medical Journal – is an interesting way of doing that, which is to say, you know, people go outdoors a lot, and a lot of their falls occur outdoors. So can you cut down the risk of their falls outdoor by giving them glasses that help them see better when they're outdoors?
So this was a study of 606 elderly people on average who were 80 years old who wore multifocal glasses and were at high risk for falling. So lots of elderly people wear glasses that help – that have different foci in them to help with distance and close-up vision. But yet, going outside, that can affect depth perception on stairs. And so the idea is to study this to see if you could change their falling related to those glasses.
Yeah. And, you know, over the year that they did this study, there were 950 falls among the 350 people. And the overall number of falls in those who wore these outdoor lenses did decrease 8% compared to the other group. But for those who went outside regularly, all falls actually fell by a significant 40%. So that's the good news.
It's great news that you can make a difference in a decrease of 40% in the people who go out very often.
Right. The little piece of bad news was if you were tend to be an indoor person, you never went outdoors. Those people actually fell a little bit more frequently,
right.
Probably because they were being pushed to go outdoors a lot more,
and maybe they weren't ready to.
But interesting research. A lot of our listeners are elderly. A lot of us have parents who are elderly. A lot of us have parents who are subject to falls. Really interesting, simple, maybe worth doing.
Absolutely. Well, we've had a chance, Adam, to talk a little bit about decreasing falls, about the importance of brushing teeth.
About the importance of children with maybe overweight, maybe needing to take fish oil supplements.
And about secondhand smoke and its relationship to mental health.
Well, that's going to conclude then our Research That Matters portions of our show.
And we're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Paul Grundy of IBM about transforming the healthcare industry. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about transforming the healthcare industry. And certainly with healthcare reform happening and with a conversation we've recently had about the patient-centered medical home and a way to use primary care to forward healthcare reform in our country, we're excited to have a conversation today about an innovative approach through the IBM Corporation and its leaders.
Yes, you know, Christy, we had our chairman, Dr. Warren Newton, on several months ago really looking at this perhaps from the patient-doctor, you know, right in the exam room perspective. And here I think we're imploding this and now just saying what's happening around the country. And we're so excited to welcome Dr. Paul Grundy, who is really a leader, recognized leader nationally on this issue. Dr. Grundy is the Global Director of Healthcare Transformation for IBM. And in this role, Dr. Grundy develops and executes strategies that supports IBM's healthcare industry transformation initiatives. He is an active social entrepreneur and speaker nationally and internationally on global healthcare transformation. And he's driving this comprehensive, linked, integrated healthcare, patient-centered medical home concept. His work has been featured in the New York Times, Business Week, The Economist, New England Journal of Medicine, one of our favorites, and newspapers, radios, and TVs around the country. And he has won numerous awards, including the U.S. Department of State Superior Honor Award. And we are honored, Dr. Grundy, that you're really here today to share some of these insights and this emerging conversations with our listeners.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You know, Dr. Grundy, Adam and I love to hear stories, and in particular, wanting to learn a little bit about you and how you became so passionate about the patient-centered medical home and about primary care. You have a long list of accomplishments and experience in healthcare, but how is it that you became so passionate about primary care?
Well, from the perspective of a large buyer of care, like an IBM corporation, we really could buy episodic-based rescue care, probably some of the best in the world is available here in the United States. But we really can't buy, in most of the geographies where we have our employees, you know, comprehensive, integrated, coordinated, and accessible care because the money all flows towards buying rescue care. And since you like stories, I'll tell you a story. I visited a major academic medical center a few weeks ago, and there was a sign out in front of the hospital that says, "We do the best heart surgery in that state." And, you know, I went in and met the leadership of that hospital, the CEO, the CFO, the CMO, all the O's, right? And I said to them, you know, we're not going to move another job into this community. It's not going to happen. And that's not the kind of sign we want to see. We want to see a sign that says, you know, we are so attentive to delivering comprehensive, integrated, coordinated care in our community that your employees will experience half the rate of heart disease that they do in other communities. And by the way, when we have to do heart surgery, we do the best. But I know exactly what you're saying with that sign. I know exactly what you're driving after. You're driving after the money. right?
Well, you know, this all of a sudden you've dove right into where I think we would love to have this conversation, because as family physicians, Christy and I work in a department that is one of the top five ranked family medicine programs in the country by U.S. News and World Report. But we think we've got that ranking because we emphasize the sorts of outcomes that the patient-centered medical home really wants to see. But yet that's not where the conversation is at as it relates to outcomes in academic medical centers across the country. And how do we change that?
So, I mean, I think the real key is to change the covenant between the buyer and the provider of care. And that's really the conversation that led us to creating the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative. It was an understanding between the buyers, companies like IBM and others, the Fortune 100, and primary care guys like you guys in family medicine that want to deliver that care. I mean, you know, we both understand that that's the equation we want to go to, but we didn't have the math adding up because the money was all flowing in the wrong direction. I mean, it all flows towards a system in which you maximize the opportunity to do invasive surgery because that's where the money is.
Get paid for more procedures, more tests, more visits versus being paid for better overall outcomes.
That's right. And so, you know, we basically said if we want to change that, and we know we have to, and by the way, we know as a nation we have to, then we need a partnership between those who want to buy better care and those who want to deliver better care. And that resulted in what's known as the joint principles of the patient-centered medical home, which in which we, the buyers, agreed with you, the providers, that there was a better way to deliver that care, which has now become, you know, really the whole concept from the bottom up of patient-centered primary care or patient-centered care, and from the top down, accountable care organizations. If you watch from the community down, it's really an ACO. From the patient's viewpoint up, it's care that's integrated, coordinated, accessible, in which attention to detail around coordination of care is there, real relationships are there. That's what we want to buy.
So let me ask,
we want to stop buying episode-based care in which the whole equation is around rescue medicine. We want to prevent those rescues from being necessary.
So let me ask you a question. Let's pretend that we are redoing the U.S. News World Report rankings. And we have a new ranking called the Patient-Centered Medical Home. And instead of it being a top-down approach, which is chairmen's around the others saying about reputation, it's a bottom-up approach that the population votes on. What are the things that are going to go into that ranking that are meaningful?
So what I would rank would be, first and foremost, what kind of relationship do you have with your provider? How well do you know them? How well do they know you? Every system that works, that's the basis of it. It's trust. I mean, before you have an accountable organization, you've got to have an accountable relationship of trust.
So start
that
with
would
that
be
doctor
my basic patient. Question would be, how well do you know? How well do you like? How well are you treated? You know, what kind of access do you have? What kind of communication do you have with your provider? When I survey my patients, right, and I ask them, do you like your doctor? They love their doctor, right? Most people do because it's a very powerful relationship. When I ask them another question, how well do you communicate with your doctor? They don't like it, right? Only about 20% like the level of communication they have.
So room for improvement.
Yeah, because the docs aren't paid to do that. The docs are paid to get those patients through as quick as they can, to see as many as they can, or go out of business.
So you would change the conversation. You are changing the conversation more towards that relationship between the doctor and the patient and the ways that we can set up practices to really foster that relationship and make it easier for patients to access their doctor.
So we use one dial, right? The only dial we use to pay is a fee-for-service dial. And we pay fee-for-service. We turn that dial up. We turn it down, we turn it up, right?
Yeah, press one if you want fee-for-service.
Right.
So you get more services, right?
Yep.
You know, there are three or four other dials you could use. I would like to pay for service, right? How happy you are with the service you get. I would like another dial that would be capitation. How well do you manage the whole population that's in your catchment area? How well do you track up and follow through? How well are diseases controlled in your community? How well are our preventive services delivered in your community. And another would be, you know, pay for performance. So how good is the quality? You take all four of those dials and you just fiddle with them a little bit because you're never going to get them right, right? You just begin to pay against all of them, right? So you don't have one single mechanism, either capitation or fee for service, because both of them are going to fail. You do only capitation, and you get people who don't want to deliver services. You do fee for service, you get too many services. So you need to, you really need to fine tune using multiple mechanisms of payment. So, I mean, I certainly wouldn't rank hospitals based on the current ranking system, which is really how well are you respected for doing rescue services, right?
But change it to asking the patients and what kind of quality and access they're getting from their doctors.
That's right. How responsive are you? How well do you communicate? Well, what kind of access tools are there? Do you answer emails? Do you have a portal solution? I mean, you're really delivering service. And then I would want to look at the data. I would want to look at the outcomes.
Sure, sure.
And I would like to rank them on how well is your community. I mean, how much less likely is it that people are going to need heart surgery in your community versus others?
That's a great change in the conversation, and this is fascinating. We do need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Paul Grundy, about transforming healthcare. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And we've been talking with Dr. Paul Grundy of IBM about the patient-centered medical home and really what I consider a transforming conversation that Dr. Grundy is bringing to the American people and that IBM, and that is really one that we're all engaged in, which is that when you're pressing that button on your telephone, when the answering machine comes on, are you pressing that fee for service, as Dr. Grundy was talking about, or are you pressing satisfaction of care, control of chronic diseases, quality of care? And I think a lot of us, Dr. Grundy, would be picking those latter buttons. And the question I really want to know is, how's it going? Are we making inroads? Because I know in President Obama's healthcare reform initiative, there is an emphasis on these elements, but is it going to take 10, 15, 20 years, or are we already getting there?
Well, first of all, I would like to say that transformation is a journey. But the agents that have always transformed society are now in high gear. So the last huge transformation that we went through in healthcare was going into and coming out of World War II, and how we structured the services around specialization and subspecialization. There was a whole infrastructure that was built around that with the DOD and the Veterans Administration. Eventually, about half of the training programs are in the Veterans Administrations affiliated with the academic medical centers. And those institutions are now migrated to 100% patient-centered medical home. There is a memo to the leadership of the DOD and the VA basically saying every DOD member, every VA member will have a patient-centered medical home. I sat in a meeting with the leadership of those organizations and the academic medical centers where they looked in the academic medical centers' leadership's faces and said, the workforce we need in the future, a workforce trained to deliver comprehensive, integrated, team-based, coordinated care, no longer episode, focus on rescue care. It's not sustainable. And so when you have those kinds of of national forces, you know, sort of leading that charge. And then we've now had 43 states that have passed laws around medical home. Most recently, Governor Strickland in Ohio signed the law on the 8th of June. I think it's the 43rd state that's passed a law around this. And you see the president's speech on June the 8th saying, how do we empower primary care physicians to be the hub of patient-centered care? That's, you know, that's the momentum. And the president spent a long time talking about that. And there is teeth in the law to allow that to happen. I think most healthcare systems, and I've been around a number of them, are beginning to say, let's stop whining, let's get on with this, because we know not exactly the form this is going to take, but we know that the system has to begin to address higher quality, lower cost.
And how do you communicate that to people? Because when I feel like so many people hear this and hear managed care, gatekeeper, fears about primary care being forced on them rather than the real understanding of the opportunity this is for higher satisfaction and higher quality care.
So the conversation we have with our employees is, I mean, how do you feel about being a milking opportunity for a healthcare system that wants to deliver high-volume, procedure-based care? I mean, it's dangerous. It's toxic. And, you know, there's got to be some sort of balance. And you really have two approaches. Once you've hit the wall, you can go to the right or the left. I mean, to the right is a system of care, you know, which some countries have used, in which there is really rationing, right?
Mm-hmm.
To the other side of the wall, you have a system of care which is relationship-based, in a relationship of trust, in which you really empower, you know, the doctor-patient relationship to have better management of care, better self-management, you know, the Danish model, or many others that have done that, where you begin to see decreases in hospitalization for chronic diseases of 50-60%, right, for ambulatory sensitive conditions.
So what you're,
that begins to really take cost out, and we're seeing that happening all over the country now in the United States too.
And so what you're really talking about is also not only strengthening this healing relationship and this relational aspect, but this accountability to the system and to the providers of that system to ensure better outcomes for patients. But it also raises the question for me of who's paying for this, because it's not necessarily in a primary care model, for instance, in our practice to do these things is more costly than the current model. We are all for it. We're actually doing it. It's more difficult, and it is a little bit more costly, particularly in a system like ours as family physicians, for which, compared to many of the other specialty colleagues, we're fairly underpaid as a discipline. So how do you and IBM and the business community advocate that we pay for these sorts of system changes?
So let's look at this logically. 5.5 to 6% of total spend in healthcare is in primary care. Yet that's probably the most important foundation of any healthcare delivery system. So you've got primary care, you know, amplifying cadence and message of health and wellness, community health, at only 6% of the spend. In systems, you know, across the United States where you really have much better outcomes, right? And we do, in fact, see 1/3 to 1/2 as much coronary artery disease. Our systems that spend 11, 12, 13% of their total spend on primary care.
Hmm.
We just got, you know, we just face it in the wrong way. So the insurance commissioner in Rhode Island did a very phenomenal thing last year. He basically said, you know, this doesn't make any sense for the state. You know, we're going to ask the healthcare plans to spend a minimum of 13% of their total spend in primary care because we've got to build that aspect of our care delivery system up. You know, those kinds of thought processes are occurring. If you listen to the speech that the president did on June the 8th, he said, you know, we're going to invest in primary care. We're going to invest in primary care providers. We understand that that's where we need to put our money.
So the train's left the station, and it's if we're not on it now, we better get on it.
You know, you better get on it as a state, because here's what you're up against. You know, there's going to be a limited supply line of primary care. I mean, we know that we've underinvested in that. So as a state, you know, you're going to be competing against other states for that supply line. And you develop a practice like a medical home-based practice where the docs love it, right? So that study done at Group Health in Seattle showed that the burnout rate was just phenomenally different for the docs in the medical home.
Because we feel better about our jobs and the care we're providing when we focus on the patients.
I mean, there's a limited number of primary care docs, and where are you going to attract those? Where are the residents finishing their training programs going to go to? Well, they're not going to go to places where they deliver care in the old model because they don't like doing that. It's no fun for them, and it's certainly no fun for my patients.
Well, that is something we, Adam and I, are certainly promoting and training our residents and in trying to attract more medical students into family medicine. But it really requires a higher level conversation, these changes in the structure and unfortunately in payment too, to try to attract more people to be that workforce.
So in North Carolina, for example, one of your major health care plans is starting to pay 30% more money when practices convert to a PCMH, a level 3 patient-centered medical home. And that's a huge differentiator in the practice.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
Do you bet that practices are going to move to that? You betcha. Is that going to empower those practices to be able to attract residents out of your training program? You betcha.
Absolutely.
Is that going to make you competitive as a state? You betcha. Other states that don't do that, honestly, I mean, you know, it's going to be a huge sucking sound. With the residents being sucked out of other states to places that are stepping up to this.
That's true.
It's really your economic survival.
Well, Dr. Grundy, we can't thank you enough for the way that you have embraced primary care and the PCMH and certainly for taking time with us today to share with us the really great work you're doing.
And thanking IBM for either you taking them along or them taking you along for the ride, but both of you together leading businesses and consumers and providers and all of us to come together. We can't thank you enough for that work.
Only a pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Paul Grundy, Global Director of Healthcare Transformation for IBM. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and experiences and your attitudes that you've written to us.
And you can send us new ones, and we will address them on an upcoming show. Send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. Better yet, call us, 919-966-8081. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Julie Steiner, to say what are some of our house calls today.
Our first question is, my son has a rash and bump on his hand and developed some red streaking up his arm. What is this, and does it mean that an infection is going to his heart, as I've been told?
Wow.
That is a great question, and one that hopefully at this point, if that's gotten worse, you've seen a doctor. Because that could, when you have a red rash or a bump and with some streaking up the arm, that could be the sign of a developing infection of the skin called a cellulitis or an inflammatory reaction of the skin, but it's important for a doctor to see that and sort it out.
Yeah. You know, Christy, when I hear the description as a rash bump on his hand, I would say, what is it? I'd say it's a rash bump on his hand.
Right.
You know, rashes are really difficult. You have to see it, really.
Mm-hmm.
And kids get rashes and bumps, and they get mosquito bites this time of year, and they're scratching them and cuts in camp, and they do get infected. So
sure.
I do worry about the stuff that you say, Christy, but I also think, it's probably not going to his heart, particularly in our days of antibiotics.
Sure,
you know what they used to call this in the old days? When it's St. Vincent's angina, it used to be because they would say it really would kill people in the old days, that cellulitis, because before the days of antibiotics, a little small cut on your hand could kill people. So nowadays, luckily, doesn't happen.
Sure. So hopefully you've gotten some antibiotics if that's – or somebody's looked at it or it's gone away on its own. But thank you for writing to us.
Yep. And actually, you could send us some pictures next time. Maybe you've got our email. Send us a little picture or two, and we'd love to then take a look at it. What do we have next, Julie?
Every now and then, I get a ringing in my ears that starts suddenly. It usually only lasts a few seconds, though. Does this mean I'm losing my hearing, and should I be worried about it?
Great question. Sounds like you are worried about it.
But, yes, to at least part of the question.
Well, so ear ringing is called I call it tinnitus, but you can also pronounce it as tinnitus.
And I'll just call it ear ringing.
Okay. But it can be caused from a lot of things. Anything from problems with your hearing, it can be a sign of hearing loss.
I was at a play recently, but I was on the far third row, far left, right in front of the speaker of a musical. And boy, after hearing that music blast for 2 hours, I had some tinnitus, some ringing in my ear.
You did. It also can be from a virus or an infection, from inflammation in your ear.
Even some medications.
Medications like aspirin.
Yeah. Too much aspirin is not a good thing.
So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're losing your hearing. But if you are having problems with your hearing or if this is getting worse, and if you're worried about it, you should definitely talk to your doctor about it.
Yeah. If it lasts just a few seconds, probably not as worried. Probably have your ears looked at and make sure you don't have big wads of wax.
Good point.
Kind of hanging out in both ears and maybe cutting down on your hearing just a little bit.
Okay, Julie, what do we have next?
How much TV is too much for my kids to watch every day? I've heard everything from 30 minutes to 2 hours per day, which seems like a lot.
Well, I would say 10 hours a day is too much.
Sure. Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics has some recommendations on this. They say if your child is less than 2 years old, they should have no TV, and that if they're older than 2 years, 1 to 2 hours per day. And there are some studies suggesting no more than 2 hours of screen time, meaning TV and video games and all of that.
Well, and you know, the research actually shows that the average American child, if you include TV and video and computers, could be doing up to 4 or 5 hours a day, which I just find hard to believe.
That seems like a lot.
On the other hand, I also find it hard to believe that the people who make some of these recommendations who say, you know, none for children under two may not have children themselves because it's really difficult at some levels. I applaud parents. Any of our listeners out there have no TVs. I applaud you. I salute you. But for this particular case, it sounds like this mother, perhaps a little biased here, but maybe the mother is in tune with some of the recommendations.
Right. And I think, you know, you want to consider their activity level to try to reduce the chance of obesity, which is one of the concerns with TV. Think about the violence and the content of what they're watching, and do the very best you can.
Yeah, I was talking with Christy recently, one of the creators of Sesame Street, and the whole idea of this, and it was this idea of creating a different genre of television that could be interactive and actually contribute to children's development. So I do think, like you were just mentioning, it really does make a difference what a child is watching. And if they're watching something that's made for young children versus something that's made for teenagers, you know, or even cartoons. I was watching a cartoon last night, but it was a cartoon for adults and was talking about suicide.
Right. Not appropriate.
Not appropriate for these young children. But, you know, you'd be sitting there just thinking, oh, he's watching cartoons.
Sure. So I think it's great that you're asking the question and you're paying attention to it. And we say, yes, pay attention and do the best you can.
Julie, what's our very last house call?
My neighbor's cat bit me last weekend. A pretty bad bite with some scratches. It was after hours, so I called the nurse line at my doctor's office. The nurse said I needed to get it checked out, so I went to the emergency department, where I waited for 2 hours before the doctor saw me. It turned out all I needed was an antibiotic to keep it from getting infected. I was really upset that I had to wait so long to be seen and that it turned out to not be anything serious. What are your thoughts?
I'd be a little bit upset with the neighbor.
The cat.
I would be upset with the doctors who saved your life, but I would be upset that, yeah, you had this neighbor's cat bit you. I don't know about this.
I would just say that I think it's good that you use the nurse line. Many people just go straight to the emergency department without using the after-hours resources that your doctor's office may have.
Or not even know that this is something that could be life-threatening because cat bites and dog bites, particularly cat bites on the hand, really they go in deeper than people think, and the amount of infection they can spread in a short period of time can be huge.
And it's a shame that you had to wait for 2 hours, but yet in an emergency department, from what Adam and I hear, 2 hours is pretty good.
Yeah, man, I'd send a donation to that emergency department right now, and with a thank you letter, because boy, they took some really good care of you to get you in that quickly and get you treated. Because again, people can die from these sort of things because they get tendon infections really quickly.
So hopefully you're getting better now that you've got your antibiotics.
Yeah. So we say that it could have been serious, and
it's good that it wasn't. Right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
We've had a chance to talk a little bit about cat bites and going to the ER.
Not putting your kids in front of a TV with commercials or with cartoons that talk about suicide.
About ringing in the ears or tinnitus.
And bumps on the hand that could be deadly, but hopefully aren't.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you for writing in to us today and for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. Please share those health-related questions with us and email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu, or call us at 919-966-8081. You can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org and follow us on Twitter by going to twitter.com and searching for Your Health Radio.
And I'm going to leave all of those messages and do all those search terms, Christy. I hope all our listeners will. We'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great producer, Julie Steiner, and our guest, Dr. Paul Grundy. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.